From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, a call for help from the UN chief, Somalia offering rewards for Al-Shabaab leaders, Kenyan president marking 2 years in office amid some security concerns, plus New York police detective demoted after tirade against a taxi driver. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon warned Thursday that civilians in Syria and Yemen are being, in his words, willfully abandoned to misery. He is urging the international community to press for an end to the violence and better protection of civilians. We get more now from VOA's Margaret Bashir at the UN in New York.
Mr. Ban told reporters the crisis in Yemen has plunged an already very poor country into a severe humanitarian crisis. He said attempts by Houthi rebels to seize more territory violate UN Security Council resolutions. This has led to an escalation in the conflict as a Saudi Arabian-led Arab coalition conducts airstrikes at the request of the beleaguered president, Abdurrabu Mansour Hadi.
The coalition air raids and the continuing attempts by the Houthis and their allied armed groups to expand their power have turned an internal political crisis into a violent conflict that risks deep and long-lasting regional repercussions. The last thing the region and our world need is more of the chaos and crimes we have seen in Libya and Syria.
The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, says that since fighting began on March 26th, about 100,000 people have been displaced and at least 74 children killed. Some hospitals and medical facilities have been attacked, and aid agencies are struggling to get in urgently needed assistance to civilians in several parts of the country. Mr. Ban said the only solution is a quick return to UN-brokered political negotiations. He's urged the international community to do everything possible to make this happen. Turning to the war in Syria, now in its fifth year, Mr. Ban said fighting there has sunk to new depths with the storming of the Yarmouk camp for Palestinian refugees by fighters from the self-styled Islamic State and allied armed groups.
In the horror that is Syria, the Yarmouk refugee camp is the deepest circle of hell.
He said the 18,000 people living there, including thousands of children, face a double danger: armed elements inside the camp and government forces outside of it.
A refugee camp is beginning to resemble a death camp.
He appealed to the international community, saying the world could not abandon the people of Yarmouk and simply stand by and watch a massacre unfold. Mr. Bond said civilians must be spared and must always be protected. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Also in the news, Iraqi political leaders say the country's military forces have begun their operation to recover parts of mostly Sunni Anbar province, which has fallen under control of the Islamic State militants. Edward Uranian is following the story from our Middle East Bureau.
Iraqi State TV reports Islamic State militants killed dozens of prisoners Thursday in the border town of Qa'im in what some say is possible retaliation for government claims that it will soon liberate Anbar province. A top Anbar tribal leader, Sheikh Naim Kaoud, said the victims come from four different Iraqi tribes and that Islamic State accused them of collaborating with Iraqi security forces. Skirmishes took place in the Anbar provincial capital of Ramadi amid expectations of a looming assault by government forces to try to retake territory lost to Islamic State militants. Large chunks of Ramadi are now under Islamic State control. Al-Hayat newspaper reported Islamic State militants pulled out of the Sajuriya district during the past 24 hours in order to regroup before the expected government assault. Anbar Council head Sabah al-Karhut says the battle to retake the province from Islamic State, which he called the scourge of our era, has begun. He insists a wide array of forces, including police, tribal fighters, and army troops, are involved in the fight. Refugees, he claimed, will soon be able to return to their homes. Anbar Province Governor Suhaib Rawi says the battle to liberate Ramadi is underway and the morale of those fighting to defeat Islamic State is high. He says arms are being distributed to local volunteers and 1,500 men are preparing to fight in Anbar's second largest city, Fallujah. During a visit Wednesday to Habaniya Air Base east of Ramadi, Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi said all Iraqis would fight together to retake Anbar province and no looting or sectarian retribution would be tolerated. Some Sunni political leaders have accused Shiite volunteer militiamen known as Hashd al-Shaabi of torturing Sunni residents of the town of Tikrit, liberated from Islamic State militants 2 weeks ago. Amateur video also showed militia members looting and burning homes and shops in and around Tikrit. Analyst James Denslow of the London-based Foreign Policy Center tells VOA complications over the liberation of Tikrit from Islamic State have pushed back projections for the battle to liberate Mosul. Anbar, he says, will be a trial for the larger battle to come.
The Iraqi military, in and of themselves, didn't have the firepower to deal with Tikrit themselves. They needed a lot of support from militias, from the Americans, etc., from the Iranians as well. So there was this real moment post-Tikrit where people were worried about revenge killings and sectarian cleansing. The whole Abadi's plan depends on this being a unity operation rather than one that seemed to be one sect winning against another.
In related developments, German media reports Islamic State militants lost control of three lucrative oil fields after being forced out of Tikrit. Some analysts say the group is able to finance part of its operations from oil sales. It still controls a number of oil fields in northern and eastern Syria. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And you can get more on this story and the rest of the day's news at our website, voanews.com. A Republican U.S. senator who authored an open letter to Iran asserting Congress's ability to override a nuclear accord now says a military strike against Tehran's atomic facilities could be achieved quickly through a bombing campaign lasting only several days, in his words. VOA's Michael Bowman reports that Tom Cotton of Arkansas has made a name for himself as the most outspoken member of a Republican faction that is not just skeptical of a nuclear agreement with Iran, but openly scornful of it.
President Barack Obama has never ruled out U.S. military action against Iran, but sees it as a final option, as he made clear in his State of the Union address in January.
The American people expect us only to go to war as a last resort. And I intend to stay true to that wisdom.
Such thinking is flawed, according to Senator Cotton, the chamber's first Iraq War veteran. He criticized the president's assertion last week that only three options exist for containing Iran's nuclear ambitions: a negotiated settlement, continued sanctions pressure, and military action.
He presented the ultimate false choice last week when he said it's either this deal or war.
Cotton appeared on a radio program produced by a conservative Christian advocacy group, Family Research Council. The senator said the United States could hold out for a better deal, as has been suggested by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Then he went on to say military action against Iran need not be a painful or protracted venture.
Even if military action were required, and we certainly should have kept the credible threat of military force on the table throughout, which always improves diplomacy, the president is trying to make you think it would be 150,000 heavy mechanized troops on the ground in the Middle East again, as we saw in Iraq. That's simply not the case.
Cotton said a military strike could mirror U.S. aerial bombardment of Iraqi facilities ordered by President Bill Clinton in the late 1990s that, as the senator put it, lasted several days. A Pentagon spokesman declined to comment to VOA on the senator's assertions, but U.S. officials have cast doubt on the ability of surgical airstrikes alone to eliminate Iran's nuclear capacity. Cotton's skepticism about a nuclear deal is hardly unique among lawmakers, but talking up the military option for dealing with Iran sets him apart from most Republicans on Capitol Hill. That said, his views are in line with hardline conservative commentators. Writing in the New York Times newspaper last month, John Bolton, who served as former President George W. Bush's United Nations ambassador, said, quote, "The inconvenient truth is that only military action can accomplish what is required," and, quote, "a strike can still succeed." Others warn of grave risks in bombing Iran. George Perkovich is a nuclear nonproliferation expert at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
The question you have to ask yourself is how long would that set back Iran's nuclear program and under what circumstances? And I think a lot of people who've looked at it have said, well, it would set it back for a short time, but it would drive it underground, take away whatever monitoring has been there, and remove the sanctions regime that has been useful in a variety of ways. And so the calculation has been that isn't as good an option as at least as trying a diplomatic option.
A new poll shows slightly more Republican voters support the framework accord than oppose it, with 40% unsure. 50% of Democrats back the deal, with nearly 40% unsure. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Somalia is placing bounties on the heads of 11 al-Shabaab leaders, including a militant group's top leader and the alleged mastermind of last week's massacre in Kenya. The bounties announced on Thursday include a reward of $250,000 for the capture of al-Shabaab chief Ahmed Omar Abu Abayed. Among the others wanted is Mohamed Mahmoud, who allegedly planned the assault on Kenya's Garissa University College. That attack left 148 students dead and dozens more wounded. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has marked 2 years in office as the country wrestles with those terrorist attacks as well as some corruption. Anniversary comes a week after the Garissa massacre. Mohammed Yusuf reporting now from Nairobi.
The two-year mark for President Kenyatta and his deputy William Ruto comes as Kenya mourns more than 140 people killed in the Garissa University College attack last week. The government is still working on identifying the bodies of those killed, as reports emerge that more than 160 students remain missing. As the president and his deputy begin their third term in office, there has been much of talk about insecurity and corruption, cases linked to top government officials, including some ministers. Mr. Kenyatta has taken a strong stand against corruption and called on all government officials and individuals involved in the alleged graft to step aside while investigations take place. So far, four ministers have done so. Barak Muluka is a political commentator. He says the two leaders will find it hard to celebrate after what happened at the university.
Anniversaries are meant to be celebratory occasions. When you come out with what we may want to call your brag sheet, your scorecard, and you don't just talk about it, you also mark it with a bit of pomp and razzmatazz, which unfortunately they can't do because of this season of mourning. And it's a season of mourning which also exposes their soft underbelly with regard to insecurity.
Kenyan government spokesman Manoah Isipisu says the criticism is unfair. He has called for Kenyans to change their way of thinking when it comes to terror attacks.
Oh, all this was in vain, and somehow people didn't care about the welfare. Jesus, our nation is at war. It's a fact that you have to live with. This country is at war. When you are at war, the same rules don't apply. And if we are at war, we need our mentality to be slightly different than it is. It's not always about us. You've got to factor in your enemy. You've got to factor in your enemy if, in fact, your enemy walks by you.
Despite security lapses, Kenyan authorities say they are doing everything possible to protect citizens from Somali militant group Al-Shabaab, which claim responsibility for the university attack. On Wednesday, authorities froze bank accounts of financial institutions, rights groups and individuals suspected of having supported the activities of Al-Shabaab. Some of the institutions include 13 Somali money transfer companies whose licenses were cancelled and bank accounts frozen. In a statement, Human Rights Watch said the list raises more questions than answers. The statement goes on to say individuals and entities on the list, including licensed agencies providing essential funds, have a right to transparency and due process. The New York-based rights group said measures taken against two human rights groups, Muslims for Human Rights Muhuri and Haki Africa, which have been documenting abuses by security forces, raise suspicion that the government is fighting critical voices and those who question the tactics used to fight terrorism in the country. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Opposition party in the Democratic Republic of Congo is protesting an electoral calendar that it says will deny many young people the right to vote in local elections this year. Nick Long has more from Goma in eastern DRC.
Opposition parties in the DRC have been contesting the electoral process for months, with deadly consequences in January when, according to Human Rights Watch, at least 40 people were killed in street protests. The government denies that figure and has said about a dozen people died. Those protests led to the announcement of an electoral calendar, but now opposition activists are contesting the date set for local and provincial elections this year, which they say is too soon. They say logistics are not in place and many young voters would be excluded. Speaking at a public meeting on the streets of Goma, Christian Bados, a local spokesman for the Engagement for Citizenship and Democracy Party, or ECIDE, said the new calendar is unconstitutional.
Le calendrier est inconstitutionnel. Kwa nini hayeshimu kalendari?
He says this is because the constitution clearly states everyone over the age of 18 has the right to vote. According to the calendar announced by Electoral Commission President Abe Apollinaire Malumalu, the local elections this year will be based on lists of voters drawn up in 2011, and anyone not on those lists will not vote. As Bados points out, that excludes people who were under 18 in 2011 but are now between 18 and 22. He told the crowd that recently many young Congolese died for the right to vote. You exerted pressure in the streets between January the 19th and the 22nd, he tells the mainly young audience, and that it is possible many Congolese died in those protests. Bados suggested there is now a question over the figure of 40 victims cited by Human Rights Watch. He says there is now an inquiry about the bodies found at Maluku Cemetery near Kinshasa. Last Friday, the government announced that more than 400 bodies have been discovered in a mass grave at Maluku. The Deputy Prime Minister said these were bodies of the destitute and of children who died in infancy. The government has announced a judicial investigation into the circumstances surrounding the grave. The United Nations mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo has welcomed that announcement and says the UN Human Rights Office will accompany the investigation. The ECIDE meeting was stopped by police after about 10 minutes. I knew the police would come, says someone in the crowd. There were no arrests and no violence. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Turning to U.S. news, the witness who recorded the fatal shooting of an unarmed African-American man by a white police officer in the U.S. city of North Charleston, South Carolina, last week, says he initially considered erasing the video from his cell phone. Fiden Santana told NBC News that Officer Michael Slager had control of the situation after subduing Walter Scott with his electric stun gun, or taser, moments after pulling Scott over for a traffic violation. Santana began recording the incident at the point when the 50-year-old Scott began running away from the police officer. Slager pulled his gun, fired 8 shots at Scott, who collapsed about 9 meters away. Santana said he felt that my life and the information with this information might be in danger. He went on to say he turned the video over to Scott's family. A lawyer for the family gave the video to the New York Times, which posted it on a website. Officer Slager was arrested and charged with murder in last Saturday's shooting of Walter Scott and has also been fired from his post. That South Carolina incident is the latest in a series of fatal encounters here in the U.S. between unarmed African-American males and white police officers. Also in the news, a New York City police detective has been ordered to give up his badge and his gun after his tirade against a driver of the Uber taxi service was videoed, recorded by a passenger in the taxi, posted online, and then it went viral. VOA's Adam Phillips reports now on the incident and how smartphone technology and social media may be changing the way police do their jobs.
It would have been an ordinary scene on a busy Manhattan street. New York City Police Detective Patrick Cherry prepared to park his unmarked car, but allegedly failed to put on his rear signal light to alert oncoming drivers. An oncoming Uber driver tapped his horn to request that Cherry make the signal. Cherry motioned for the driver to pull over and approached his vehicle. Here's an edited collection of excerpts from that exchange, as recorded by passenger Seth Sanjay from the rear seat.
Sir, you understand me?
Sir, I am not saying...
You understand me?
Yes, I understand.
Okay, so stop it with your mouth. Okay. You understand me?
Yes,
I don't know what planet you think you're on right now.
I'm not planning, sir. I'm here.
Planning? I said planet.
I'm not planning.
The only reason you're not in handcuffs going to jail is because I have things to do. Okay. That's the only reason that's not happening. Because this isn't important enough for me. You're not important enough.
Sanjay later posted his recording on YouTube, where it went viral. Within days, Detective Cherry was told to surrender his badge and gun. And the NYPD and the city's own police watchdog agency had begun independent investigations of the case. It's fair to say that without Sanjay's smartphone and social media, Cherry could have expected a milder outcome. Social media had embarrassed the NYPD before. Last summer, for example, a bystander used his smartphone to record police officer Daniel Pantaleo putting an unarmed man named Eric Garner in a chokehold during an arrest. Garner later died. Mass demonstrations ensued. Still, even though police can assume there may be citizen smartphones trained on them much of the time, Robert Ganji of the Police Reformed Organizing Project doubts that that knowledge will fundamentally affect how some police officers approach their work.
Back, Dan Pantaleo, the officer in the Eric Garner case, he said he wouldn't have changed anything about what he did if he knew that he was being filmed. There might be some kind of very slight adjustments that some officers make because they have that in mind before they use excessive force or speak very disrespectfully or engage in racial slurs. Our view is social media is more significant in that it can expose the problem, educate and arouse people to the problem, and lead to political pressure to change things. And I think that has extraordinary value.
But the news value of what is recorded on smartphones and broadcast on social media has University of California journalism professor Willa Seidenberg deeply concerned. She says with no professional quality control, recordings can be manipulated for emotional effect or faked.
In the old days, before there was all this ubiquitous media, we relied on sort of gatekeepers to tell us what was going on in the world. And while that might have provided some context and analysis to a situation, it also meant that there were a lot of things that weren't brought to light. So I really look at these kinds of situations as a double-edged sword. You have an ability for anybody to make something public, which means there's going to be room for abuse of the way it's used.
Seidenberg hopes that the recorded tirade by Detective Cherry against the Uber driver and similar cases will lead to enhanced training for police officers going forward, and that may lead to fewer incidents of rudeness and abuse by police. Yet she's doubtful that such incidents will ever end completely. Technology will continue to expand, she says, but human nature will continue to be stubborn. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And President Obama in Panama for a summit at which he's expected to have an encounter with Cuban leader Raul Castro. We get more now from VOA's Luis Ramirez.
There is no formal meeting planned, but White House officials said President Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro will interact. Earlier in Jamaica, Mr. Obama stopped short of announcing a U.S. government decision to take Cuba off its list of state sponsors of terrorism.
As you know, there's a process involved in reviewing whether or not a country should be on the state sponsor of terrorism list. That review has been completed at the State Department. It is now forwarded to the White House.
But the U.S. leader said a process still needs to happen, and he said he would not be making a formal announcement just yet. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, Panama City.
And that is the news here on The Voice of America. Thanks for tuning in to International Edition. The latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jim Harmon, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
I'm Neil Arcega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In another sign of the United States' determination to help the nations of Africa combat terrorism, millions of dollars in rewards are being offered for information on several top leaders of the Al-Qaeda-linked Somalia-based terrorist organization Harakat Shabab al-Mujahideen, or Al-Shabaab. The group, listed as a foreign terrorist organization since 2008, is battling that nation's government for control of Somalia and has also carried out a string of attacks in Kenya, most recently at a college in the town of Garissa. It is responsible for the deaths of thousands of Somali civilians, peace activists, international aid workers, journalists, and civilians, as well as African Union peacekeepers who are helping to restore stability and prosperity to the region. Tens of thousands of people have been forced to flee their homes amid the fighting. Under the terrorist designation, the United States imposed financial and other restrictions on the group, blocking property and prohibiting U.S. persons from engaging in transactions with its members. Now the U.S. is offering rewards for information leading to the location of six of its leaders. Rewards of up to $5 million each are offered for information on the location of Ibrahim Haji Jama, also known as Abu Zalma, Fuad Mohammed Khalaf, a dual Somali and Swedish national, also known as Fuad Shungala, Bashir Mohammed Mahmoud, an al-Shabaab military commander believed to have been born between 1979 and 1982, and Mukhtar Robo, a 43-year-old who has served as an al-Shabaab spokesman and who carries an Eritrean passport. Rewards of up to $3 million each are offered for information on the location of two additional al-Shabaab leaders, Abdullahi Yare and the group's intelligence chief, Zakaria Ismail Ahmed Hersey, also known as Zaki Madobi. The United States guarantees all credible reports will be investigated, and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these men, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.